Okay. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. Mideast Madness for August the 5th. Monday, August the 5th, it is 3:01 p.m. May as well give you the phone numbers right away. Area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-3772. That's line number one. And just to be doubly nice, we have a line two, 469-3119. Again, line two is 469-3119. These episodes of Santa Cruz, of Free Radio Santa Cruz's very own Mideast Madness, can generally be found at the archives at radioforall.net. That's radio, the character for, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. Just plug in Mideast Madness and browse through the titles. Again, this is the live show for August 5th, 2013. It is 3:03 p.m. My name is Ren. And we are still looking for a site, for a geographical piece of real estate, very small piece, with access to electric power, for our radio transmitter. We are currently an internet-only radio service on the World Wide Web. It's remarkable how, considering if you're even up in the space station, you can pick up our program. Anywhere else in the world that has internet access, in the world, folks. But next to nobody is listening to this show right now, I can tell you, the live show anyway, because since we were forced to leave the air around the beginning of last month, over 5 weeks ago, I fear... that people will not believe that Free Radio Santa Cruz is still here, is still there. They will not know that we're streaming, or won't care, or quickly forget that we're streaming on the net if they don't have access to the internet. So people within the city of Santa Cruz have been absent. All over-the-air transmission of our free radio programs, as we're currently and temporarily, I assure you, without transmitted signal. So if you're used to dialing us up on your traditional little radio set there, please be patient. But if you happen to catch wind of what I'm saying through whatever venue you end up hearing this on, be assured that that Free Radio Santa Cruz is still most definitely alive and well. Could be better, but we're well enough to do the show. We have our studio. All the hardware is still in the studio. We just don't have an antenna right now. No transmission tower. So we'll be back plugging ahead at full steam once we get that problem out of the way. You know, you can call me on one of those lines, some of the phone lines that I gave, 427-3772 or 469-3119. If you have something to offer or some creative idea, some assistance in seeing us to that end, all of us, folks, Also, you can contact me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com for any reason, any message. This show is going to be almost exclusively about Dr. Jeff Halper, PhD, and his writings, his musings, his activity. Who is Dr. Jeff Halper, PhD? He was in town here in Santa Cruz, California, last April and gave a talk. Personally, I met the man just about 5 years ago to the day, roughly, at the beginning of August of 2008 on the island of Cyprus. Soon enough, I learned that he was co-founder and the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Sorry. Which, as you can imagine, refers to demolishing Palestinian homes, almost always illegally, by international law, if not by Israeli law. This is even occasionally done in violation of Israeli national law, demolishing homes of Palestinians, whether they live inside the recognized state of Israel or they're in the militarily occupied territories of Palestine. You ain't supposed to do that. So, Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Oh, as I was saying, I found that out about him, what he does for a living. Discovered that he's a very prolific author and has even written books since then, in the five-year interim since we met. And he was even nominated just a few years before that in the early 2000s. Nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, which, unsurprisingly, he did not win. That's no slam intended against Jeff. It's just that anyone who does something for the Palestinian cause, which is to say the cause of peace and justice in that region for Palestinians and Israelis, Israeli, Jew, and non-Jew alike, very unlikely that such a person with that resume will receive a Nobel Prize. That's my opinion. And he and I buddied up on the voyage to the Gaza Strip and the port of Gaza City. One of two vessels, the first two vessels to successfully traverse that part of the Mediterranean between Larnaca, Cyprus, and Gaza City. Two old Greek fishing boats in 2008. The founding voyages of the Free Gaza Movement, a coalition of activists and human rights activists, both in the United States and from many other countries. Dr. Jeff Halper has been a peace and human rights activist for more than three decades. Born in Minnesota, he participated in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements of the 1960s. Halper immigrated to Israel in 1973, after attending rabbinical school and resisting military service in the Vietnam War. In Israel, Halper taught anthropology at Haifa and Ben-Gurion universities. His academic research has focused on the history of Jerusalem in the modern era, contemporary Israeli culture, and the Middle East conflict. He is the author of Between Redemption and Revival, The Jewish Yishuv in Jerusalem in the 19th century. The Hebrew word yishuv refers to those Arab Jews, they were generally referred to as Arab Jews, who lived in Palestine, in the historic region of Palestine, before the beginning of the Zionist colonial movement. So there were indeed a few thousand Arab Jews, or Yishuv, who lived in Palestine, preceding Zionist immigration of Jews from around the world. Author of Between Redemption and Revival, The Jewish Yishuv in Jerusalem in the 19th century. During his mandatory Israeli military service, he refused to bear arms or to serve in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 1997, Halper co-founded the ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, ICAHD, to challenge and resist the Israeli policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. Now, that's the blurb from the original invite to his last appearance in Santa Cruz here. He lives in Jerusalem, but makes it over here. I've seen him in Santa Cruz twice since our voyage together with some 42 other activists on those two boats. He was last here on April 14th, giving his presentation at the Resource Center for Nonviolence there on Ocean Street. Okay. I think I'm going to see if I can succeed in copying this. And, oh my. Just having a good time on my pewter here, folks. Very good. Let's save that. And we're going to get to a couple of his writings. As I promised last week, the last Monday in July, I would finish, I would read that very long piece that I came across written by Dr. Halper, because it contains his prognosis for getting from here to there in Israel-Palestine, or as some prefer to call it, Palestine-Israel. Does it really matter what we call it? There are real people living there on both sides of the Green Line, and a lot of lack of parity between the two societies. Making sure my phones are on here. Call in any time. Don't worry about interrupting me. First, the shorter piece. This is the latest commentary from Dr. Jeffrey Halper, directly from his website, from the ICAD website, actually, entitled Kerry's Pax Israeliana Has Failed. What next? Kerry, of course, refers to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, former Democratic Party nominee for the presidency of the U.S. This is dated July 4th, just about a month ago. Kerry's Pax Israeliana Has Failed. What next? Jeff Halper. How do we respond to Kerry? I don't know of anyone familiar with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict across the board who sees in the Kerry initiative anything other than an attempt to impose on the Palestinians a Pax Israeliana. In fact, neither Kerry nor his Israeli partners bother to deny it. Be right with you here. Okay. For his part, Kerry's main contribution to this latest incarnation of the long moribund quote-unquote peace process is a vague $4 billion package of, and I quote here, incentives. Part of what Amira Haas, incentives. Part of what Amira Haas, who is a resident of Israel and writes for Haaretz, part of what Amira Haas calls hush money. $4 billion package that strikes, that bears a striking resemblance to the quote-unquote economic peace that that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israeli President Shimon Peres have been trying to peddle for years. Otherwise, Kerry is merely pressing the Palestinians to accept Israel's preconditions for negotiations and its version of a two-state solution, which is to say, no end to settlement construction, land expropriation, house demolitions. Incidentally, 28,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished since 1967. 28,000 homes and counting. And no end to settlement construction, land expropriation, house demolitions, or displacement. Recognition of Israel as a, quote, Jewish state. The imposition of the Clinton parameters on East Jerusalem, which is to say, what is Jewish is Israeli, what is Arab is Palestinian, thus eliminating completely any kind of coherent urban entity that might serve as the Palestinians' capital. Continuing with Kerry's Israel's preconditions. Israel's retention of at least six major settlement blocks, BLOCS, strategically placed to fragment the West Bank into disconnected and impoverished cantons, while isolating what remains of East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank. Long-term or permanent Israeli military control over the Jordan Valley and Palestine's borders with Egypt and Jordan. Well, the list goes on. Israeli control over Palestinian airspace, over their electromagnetic sphere, in other words, communications, etc., etc., etc. Again, I am reading from the latest commentary from Dr. Jeff Halper's ICAD website. Continuing with commentary. Despite the fact that a majority of Israeli Jews favors a two-state solution of some sort and hold fairly negative views of the settler enterprise, no solution that even approaches the Palestinian demand for a viable, truly sovereign, territorially contiguous state with East Jerusalem as its capital has a chance of passing through the Knesset. And the Knesset is the State of Israel's parliament in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is not universally recognized as Israel's capital, and legally, officially in the U.S., we still consider Tel Aviv to be Israel's capital. Even if it was approved by referendum, and the will on the part of the United States, Congress in particular, to force Israel to accept such a solution is missing altogether, as Kerry's lackluster diplomacy demonstrates. Why, then, engage in the exercise at all? Well, there really is no compelling reason. The United States, like Israel, has always downplayed any linkage between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the dynamics of the wider Middle East. Indeed, it portrays Israel as a valued ally, he italicizes her here, an ally in the war on terrorism, which is the lens through which American administration regard the region. Israel is an ally in the war on terrorism. It certainly wouldn't hurt if Israel's interminable oppression of the Palestinians ended, and to the degree that the U.S. feels international isolation over its absolute support for Israel, it might even help America's standing. Hence, Kerry's push, or better, nudge, towards starting negotiations before the United Nations convenes in September and the Palestinians score some other symbolic victories. But Kerry's unwillingness to walk away from the process if, in quotes here, the sides do not cooperate, as if we're speaking of two players of equal clout and responsibility, indicates that his government can live with the occupation indefinitely. I'm still here, taking a sip. I'm hoping this damn computer doesn't poop out on me. I'm getting a blinking pale blue shade. I'm trying to remember what that means. Blinking on and off occasionally on my text here. Continuing with commentary. Israel's ambivalence, bordering on disinterest, also bespeaks any genuine sense of urgency. True, Netanyahu is concerned lest a binational state ultimately emerges between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. But he also believes that a combination of hush money to the Palestinian elites, continued humanitarian aid by the international community, and outright pacification, including self-pacification by a Palestinian authority, is sufficient to push the Palestinian issue off his list of priorities. When I'm done with this commentary, this editorial here, I will talk more about terminology such as binational state and this and that. Continuing. Interestingly, both Netanyahu and Tzipi Livni, who is the minister in charge of negotiations, have conceded that the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, poses a threat to Israel. And more than simply an economic threat. Calls for an economic boycott may have started with the settlements, says Livni. And then in quotes here, but the European Union's problem is with Israel, which is seen as a colonialist state. It won't stop with the settlements, but will spread to the rest of the country, end quote. That's Tzipi Livni talking. But that threat, too, diminishes in light of the eagerness of EU member states to purchase Israeli arms and high-tech products. Nor do they want to tangle with the U.S. over the Palestinian issue. So, yeah, why not try once more to reach peace, quote-unquote, with the Palestinians, especially since the American-brokered process does not fundamentally endanger Israel's major settlement blocks, its sovereignty over East Jerusalem, or, in fact, its overall control of the West Bank. The Palestinians, Netanyahu reckons, have nowhere to go. On the ground, they are exhausted, politically and physically fragmented, and cannot resist to any significant degree. Politically, their cause is steadily losing ground as it ceases to be an international flashpoint and disappears from view, despite periodic initiatives like Kerry's or symbolic votes in the UN. That last clause there, such as symbolic votes in the UN, obviously refers to last November's acceptance by the UN General Assembly of the Palestinian Authority's bid, request, to be recognized as a non-observer state, or a non-voter state. I think non-observer state is what they formally refer to it as. Where was I? So if Kerry's mission succeeds, Israeli leaders calculate we can either enter into negotiations That will lead to a de facto apartheid by consent. The preferred outcome, or drag them out interminably. It really doesn't matter, since either scenario leaves Israel in control, our major settlements intact. Of course, Professor Dr. Halper is speaking as an Israeli when he says our major settlements intact, taking a citizen's responsibility for his nation's antics. Continuing, and if Kerry's efforts fail, well, we can easily blame the Palestinians for that and return peacefully to the status quo ante. The way things were before this latest effort, ante is Latin for before, status quo ante. All this is not merely cynical statecraft, nor is it unique to the Israeli-Palestinian case. It goes to the very heart of international politics, to a fundamental reality we who seek a genuinely better world must grasp if we are to develop effective strategies to contend with it. That reality is that governments do not resolve conflicts, certainly not on the basis of human rights, international law, and concerns over justice. They merely manage them. Dr. Jeff Halper, saw that clearly in a recent meeting with the officials of the Middle East desk of a major European government. That government is one of the most critical of Israel in Europe, a stalwart of human rights, and in fact a supporter of BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, having divested all state pensions from Elbit Systems, a profitable Israeli military company. Yes, they told me, we work assiduously to end the occupation and to reach a two-state solution, the only one acceptable to us. But what, I asked, if you yourselves became convinced that the two-state solution was gone, would you consider another approach, a single democratic state, for example, or a binational one? No, never, they replied. Look, they explained to me, it's true we are against Israel's occupation, but Israel itself is a friendly country to us. We cooperate on NATO matters and encourage our business people to trade with Israel. This is a European country that is one of the most ardently critical of Israel. Continuing. We would never do anything to harm it. Therefore, we cannot go ahead beyond a two-state solution. But if you are convinced that that solution is gone, I persisted, what would happen then? In that case, they answered, we would merely increase our humanitarian aid to the Palestinians. We could never accept any solution besides two states that would jeopardize the integrity and security of Israel. In other words, this resolute defender of human rights in the international community could live very well with injustice and apartheid if no solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict was forthcoming. This structural support, yes, structural in italics here, this structural support for Israel carries one proviso, however. Israel must keep the lid on. Management means to essentially disregard situations that do not disrupt the international system or the core interests of its major blocs, focusing instead on extinguishing immediately disruptive flashpoints. Even wars represent more conflict management, securing resources and trade routes while keeping troublesome elements at bay, than a sometimes necessary measure in actually resolving an issue. the message of the government that I visited and others to Israel is this. We will continue to extend to you our de facto support on the condition that your suppression of the Palestinians remains, quote unquote, under the accepted radar. That the occupation becomes neither a flashpoint, as it did during the intifadas and the attacks on Gaza, requiring our attention, or an embarrassment to our official support of human rights. This is what Israel has largely succeeded in doing. The fact that the conflict continues to fester, however, especially because people around the world refuse to let it disappear, is enough to bring Kerry to the region. It is not enough, though, to generate meaningful pressures on Israel to actually end its occupation. If this is the case, then what are we grassroots activists to do? First, we must realize that we are in a bad marriage. Governments claim an exclusive right to run our, Israel's, international affairs. Only they can raise armies, negotiate, sign treaties. That is why we expect them to assume leadership and solve the world's problems. But they don't do that. They won't go beyond conflict management dictated by their own collective interests. Only when public pressures from below force them to act, indeed, only when public resistance forces a collapse in the status quo that compels them to genuinely address the fundamental grievances, will governments do the right thing. The realization that we need governments, if only to nail down the solutions we ourselves espouse, provides direction to our strategies for change. We, the people, must be the ones to formulate the outlines of just solutions to conflicts. Governments will not do that. They will merely look for the path of least resistance. And we must then forge effective strategies for forcing our solutions, or at least the principles underlying just solutions, on them. Finally, we must closely monitor how they conduct negotiations, insisting that they be transparent and that they genuinely address the issues in a just manner. We must keep them honest. I'm still with you here. Okay, I looked at that. Continuing with commentary. In terms of achieving a just peace between Palestinians and Israelis, something that would break down the barriers that divide us meaning the Israelis and the Palestinians, and contribute measurably to the people's ability to address the need for change throughout our region, we as civil society still have a long way to go. The logical progression of civil society involvement, formulating an acceptable solution, effectively pursuing it, and in the meantime monitoring political developments, is lacking. Through BDS and other campaigns, we have in fact generated meaningful pressure on governments to justly resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but we have not formulated an alternative to the two-state solution, which Israel and the U.S. have effectively eliminated. I'm going to read that again, just so we all understand. Through BDS, boycott, divestments, and sanctions, and other campaigns, we human activists, we have in fact generated meaningful pressure on governments to justly resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but we have not formulated an alternative to the two-state solution, which Israel and the United States have effectively eliminated. This is the most urgent item on our agenda. Without an endgame formulated by Palestinians in conjunction with their Israeli counterparts, We cannot successfully insert ourselves into the political process, nor can we effectively monitor political developments, such as Kerry's initiative. We must then at least define the principles upon which to evaluate whether political initiatives like Kerry's are just and honest. I offer the following for consideration. I have presented these five principles elsewhere, but it might be useful to look at them in this context, if only to generate needed discussion. Here are Dr. Jeff Halper's five principles. One. A just peace and the process leading up to it must conform to human rights, international law, and UN resolutions. Two, regardless of whether there should or should not have been an Israel, two peoples now reside in Palestine-Israel, and a just peace must be based on that binational reality. Three, a just peace requires an acceptance of the Palestinian refugees' right of return. Four, a just peace must be economically viable with all the country's inhabitants enjoying equal access to the country's resources and economic institutions. And five, a just peace must be regional in scope. By itself, Israel-Palestine is too small a unit to address all the issues at stake in the conflict, and it must address the security concerns of all in the region. Last paragraph of the commentary. If it's true that governments merely manage conflicts and place their own interests above those of human rights and international law, it is up to us to monitor any process they initiate, to keep it honest. Formulating a set of principles through which we can evaluate whether they are genuinely addressing the issues at hand or trying to impose an unjust but manageable, quote-unquote, solution is crucial, not for Israel-Palestine alone, but in regard to any of the world's innumerable conflicts. Dr. Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And yes, there are indeed many legal and functioning organizations, projects, and foundations within Israel, most of the time led by, if not majority comprised of Jews, Israeli Jews, who actively seek justice for everyone, Palestinians and Jewish Israelis and non-Jewish Israelis. Remember that one out of every five Israelis is not Jewish. Most of them are Muslim, many are Christian, and there are others. But by and large, the non-Jews are always referred to as Israeli Arabs. They are, of course, Palestinians to begin with, so they may also rightfully be referred to as Israeli Palestinians. Okay, I see what's going on now. I'm getting this blue tinge because I got a bad connection somewhere. I guess I'm going to have to put up with the blue tinge. Okay, it's gone away now. ICAD, Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, is one of these many Israeli institutions, which is not by any means in lockstep with the governing regime of Israel, not in lockstep with its leading political party, the Likud, not in lockstep with this Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is an ultra-rightist and, in my opinion, racist fascist, referring to Netanyahu. Incidentally, you can see more at www.icahd.org. I think the most important overall message that Dr. Helper is passing along to us is that, to put it one way, Helper, and most likely his colleagues at ICAD, hold the so-called initiatives like the Kerry peace process in complete contempt, recognizing that by its nature, that kind of peace initiative can go nowhere. Dr. Helper is trying to tell us that rather than really try to jumpstart a new beginning to a real peace process, Kerry, who is a Democrat, and I hate to have to say this about a Democrat in the U.S. government, but Kerry is merely a kind of apparatchik, a tool for the government to show the world that we are supposedly doing something about that conflict over there, and going through the motions to make it look like they're trying to start a peace process when even Kerry himself knows full well, in terms of what he's really thinking in his head while he talks peace to the world through the microphones and through to the media, Kerry knows that in terms of facts on the ground, in terms of what's actually going to happen, nothing is going to really change, that the settlements will not be stopped, even though they're considered by the world community to be illegal, both in their being founded in Palestinian territory and by the fact that they're expanding into Palestinian territory and displacing indigenous Palestinians. Kerry knows that. He knows that. And that all realistic hope for a truly contiguous, that's geographically continuous and contiguous, Palestinian state is gone, particularly if the settlements remain under Israeli control. He must recognize, I'm guessing, it doesn't take a lot of effort to guess, that Secretary of State John Kerry cannot deny that all this activity by Israel in their militarily occupied West Bank and economically sanctioned Gaza Strip is against international law. Much of it is collective punishment, a term which has only gotten attention by most of the rest of the world in the last 2.5 years since the beginning of the Syrian civil war. And of course, the press harps down on Syria's Assad's government as they commit collective punishment on its people and on the protesters. But all these years, all these decades, Israel has continuously afflicted the Palestinians with collective punishment in a variety of ways. It's currently happening en masse now in Gaza by a very stringent economic siege against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And Dr. Helper that's his main thing through this article. He's describing in depth about how the U.S. initiative is not going to amount to anything other than possibly making us look good, at least to the dumber people in the world community. He goes over there, he makes a few noises, he comes back, and then you don't hear anything about a peace process again. Israel, by its very nature, is a colonialist state. Its founding principles of Zionism, as they chose to call it in the late 1800s, are not theological principles based in Judaism. they could be said to be based in a recognition of the historic ancestral foundations of the Jewish faith in that part of the world. But they are not truly theological. They are political. Zionism is a political colonialist movement, which by its very nature is racist. Yes, I'm using the R word again. Racist means racist, and I cannot say it enough. Let's get to this second piece by Jeff. This was also a commentary by him three commentaries ago. But it is indeed very in-depth. When Jeff was here in town giving his talk at the RCNV on Ocean Street, the title of that talk... Oh, boy. Okay. It didn't come out like I wanted it to. Yes, I know. I could have taken care of this stuff in my prep, but I didn't have time for any prep this morning. I overslept. When he was in town in April, his talk was entitled something like Imagine a New Future in Israel-Palestine. Well, this commentary by Dr. Helper was dated... Something is weird here because it says October 4. I guess he has the month and the date switched. April 10th. From last day, April 10 of 2013. This one is entitled Towards an Endgame in Palestine, Israel, While Imagining the Future. An Endgame in Israel, Palestine. From Jeff's desk. Now, if you were listening closely to the commentary by him that I just finished, you'll know that Jeffrey is very intelligent, is a wordsmith par excellence, as are so many of the others who write the pieces that I read to you, and they can put you to sleep if you're not really into it. I always find myself asking people to bear with me, to bear with the author as well, and to appreciate the fact that while they use a lot of big words and they get really into the meat of things, presuming a certain familiarity with the subject on the reader, this one is about three or four times as long. But I think it's really important because it brings you into the heart and soul of Dr. Helper. And also, as I used the word before, contains his prognosis for achieving peace, freedom, sovereignty, and security in the Holy Land, what's sometimes referred to as the Holy Land. So roll up your sleeves, drink, have a couple of put the pot of coffee on if you haven't already. Regular listeners to this show will know that they need to do that at the beginning of the two-hour segment. Let's dive into it. From Jeff's desk, last April 10th. Last September, ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, which had long argued that the two-state solution was dead, decided to bite the bullet and endorse a one-state solution. We first circulated a draft among our Palestinian partners for comment. The reaction was deafening in its silence. Either fewer of our counterparts than we thought were willing to abandon the two-state solution, the goal of their national liberation struggle these past 25 years, roughly since the beginning of the First Intifada, the goal of their national liberation struggle for one state, or they objected to our framing it within a framework of binationalism. In the end, we pulled back. putting out instead a position paper in which we try to insert a critical Israeli voice into the one state formulation. It is clear that despite the fact that most Palestinians realize that the two-state solution is gone, they have as of yet to shift to a one-state solution in meaningful numbers. And again, folks, we will get into definitions and the meanings of the various proposed solutions for this infamous problem. Okay. So they went from an out-and-out endorsement of a one-state solution to issuing a position paper. Continuing with Dr. Jeffrey's commentary. While I understand the dilemma of moving from a solution that, in principle at least, is acceptable to the international community to one that has little chance of being accepted, a nagging feeling of frustration and fear has dogged me ever since. How could we be in the midst of a political struggle without a political endgame? What do we say to political decision makers, the general public, or our own activists when they ask, "What is it exactly that you want?" Ending the occupation provides a partial answer at best. Indeed, we shifted to the one-state solution because, in our view, the occupation will end and a Palestinian state will not emerge in that small and fragmented territory. At the same time, we fully appreciate the Palestinians' reluctance to give up a national liberation struggle in favor of a struggle for civil rights, which is what a one-state solution inclusive of Israeli Jews would entail, even if it was achievable. You still awake, folks? I'm trying to sound excited as I read this to you, so I won't monotone you to death here. Continuing with commentary. We are, in short, between solutions. We are in a state of transition from the two-state solution, proposed solution, to something as yet unidentified. That is to be expected. Political struggles must adapt to changing circumstances and adjust their strategies and even their end goals accordingly. But if we are to maintain our political momentum, we must transit fairly quickly to an end game that genuinely resolves the conflict. BDS, boycotts, divestments, sanctions, is a valuable tactic for keeping the issue alive, but it cannot replace an end game and an effective strategy for achieving it. This paper attempts to hasten the process of transitioning to a new endgame by making the case for a democratic yet binational state. Not that this necessarily... I'm sorry, folks. This is driving me crazy. I love pretty pastel shades, but not when they're blinking on and off my monitor all the time. Okay, I think it seemed to be stable again. Let me digress here slightly. This paper attempts to hasten the process of transitioning to a new endgame by making the case for a democratic and yet binational state between Israel and Palestine, inclusive of Israel and Palestine. Not that this necessarily is the solution, and it certainly needs to be fleshed out, but discussing it helps clarify the issues at stake. It brings out fundamental differences of view upon which a constructive and much needed exchange is based. It is incumbent upon us, the grassroots civil society, to formulate solutions that, if not ideal, contain elements that progressives can support and advocate. For governments will not do this. They are not our partners. Rather than resolving conflicts, the international community, including the United Nations, merely manages them. As I read about to you in his first commentary this afternoon. And if a fellow government like Israel can subdue the Palestinians to a point where they cease to disrupt the international system, they can live perfectly well with occupation, apartheid, and warehousing. It is up to us to formulate a genuine and just solution, or at least direction, and then generate pressure from below on governments to act. That's just the way it works. So if this paper can help crystallize the issues and catalyze discussion, it will have served its purpose. Okay, now the good doctor gets into the range of possible solutions. We're talking peace in the Middle East here, folks. This, in the view of Dr. Helper, is how it goes. The range of possible solutions. The best place to start is to survey the various quote-unquote solutions that are out there, each espoused by a different community of interest and therefore of significance, even if in the end they prove unacceptable. The range of possible solutions and their advocates goes something like this. First, two states, which is to say a majority of Palestinians living in Palestine and, in principle, most Israeli Jews. I don't get it. Two states, majority of Palestinians living in Palestine and, in principle, most Israeli Jews. I think he's trying to say most Israeli Jews living in Israel. The internationally accepted, yes, there are a lot of terrible, especially in the last couple of paragraphs, awful typos in this thing. I don't know if that's Jeff's fault or who, but anyway, the internationally accepted solution to the conflict envisions partitioning the country, historic Palestine, between the two peoples so that each enjoy national self-determination, although Israel would occupy 78% of the country and the Palestinian state only 22%. The two-state solution is also supported by the majority of Israeli Jews. In a Peace Index survey in 1999, before the complete collapse of the Oslo peace process, it garnered the support of 58%. Only 15% favored the binational model, while 7.5% said there was no way out of the conflict. The number of those supporting the two-state solution rose to 78% in 2003 during the Second Intifada. This was not because Israeli Jews were convinced that a two-state solution would actually resolve the conflict, explains Tamar Herman of the Peace Index, but because they desired, quote, separation from the Arabs, or a, quote, divorce in the inimical words of Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak was the prime minister of Israel during the much-flouted peace process during Bill Clinton's time in office here in the U.S. And it is 4 p.m., 1600 hours, here on the west coast of North America, Pacific Daylight Time. This is the August 5th, 2013 episode of Mideast Madness, brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are streaming live at freakradio.org. I've already given you the phone numbers. I know damn well how many people are listening, so I won't even bother to give them out again. Let's see if our audience has increased at all. Nope. Back to the commentary. Of course, in politics, one can never shut the door completely on solutions, and the same is true of the two-state solution. It could be salvaged. The two-state solution could be salvaged if according to Dr. Halper. Israel accepted the General Assembly vote of November 2012 recognizing Palestinian sovereignty over the occupied territories and agreed that Palestine become a full member state of the UN. If Israel formally acknowledge the Palestinians' right to national self-determination within the 1967 lines, which, by the way, has never been done to date, and if the settlements which would fall under Palestinian rule would be integrated, Israeli residents allowed to stay in their homes as Israeli citizens living in mixed cities in Palestine, a situation in which the occupation could be ended without having to physically dismantle the settlements, the major obstacle to achieving a two-state solution. All this being highly unlikely, and with the U.S. and Europe unwilling to force Israel out of the occupied territory, the two-state solution exists on paper only, hence the necessary shift to a binational solution. Nevertheless, PNGO, the Palestinian Non-Governmental Organization Network of almost 100 left-oriented associations, keeps the two-state solution alive by continuing to promote these three fundamental principles for resolving the conflict. One, ending Israel's occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the oft referred to as the security wall, dismantling the wall. Two, recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And three, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in United Nations Resolution 194. Now, if you pay attention to any of these numbers, folks, like when we're talking about UN resolutions, they are now in the thousands, at least the 1,000 or 2,000 areas. UN Resolution 194, therefore, obviously goes back towards the foundation of the UN shortly after the end of the Second World War in 1945. The war ended in 45. The actual, on paper, formal charter of the United Nations was written up in San Francisco in 1950. But there was something in the United Nations that was functioning, I think, out of Europe at the time, before they built their complex on Manhattan. And it was that nascent United Nations organization that issued in 48 or 49 Resolution 194, which, among other things, called for Israel to respect, protect, and promote the rights of Palestinian refugees and allow them to return to their homes and properties. That was Resolution 194, way back when, about 65 years ago. Continuing with Dr. Halper's commentary, ICAD and a number of critical left Israeli, as in left-leaning Israeli organizations, accept these principles. The vast majority of Israeli Jews, even among the majority that support, in principle, the two-state solution, consider them, however, merely another means of achieving a single Palestinian-dominated state. In other words, these are the Jews who fear political domination and perhaps cultural domination of their own Jewish state of Israel by the Palestinians. That's the single Palestinian-dominated state that the doctor's talking about here. Okay. Discussing the range of possible solutions as the doctor sees them. That's the scenario for two states. Now we enter in another version of two states. Apartheid as even if they don't use the word apartheid, as it is laid out by labor and center-left Israeli governments. Successive Israel governments have expressed vague support for the two-state solution, either coerced out of them by American leaders or hinted at. For labor-led Israeli governments, the two-state solution has always meant three things. One, separating Israelis from Palestinians, or in Hebrew, Hafrada, or in Afrikaans, apartheid. So do in the tradition of folk traditions, we probably should say Hafrada instead of apartheid. Two, seizing control of the occupied territory, East, in quotes, East Jerusalem, which Israel has formally annexed some decades ago, in fact, the massive settlement blocks in the West Bank, the Jordan Valley and the country's borders, airspace, and even the electromagnetic sphere, including all its resources from water to tourism. And three, finding collaborators who will agree to Palestinian autonomy on as little non-contiguous land as possible without compromising Israeli security. Indeed, the settlement blocks and the root of the wall or fence clearly delineate a fait accompli, a truncated Bantustan, getting into Afrikaans vocabulary, a truncated Bantustan on only 15% of historic Palestine. 15%, folks. Less than a fifth. The only problem left to resolve is how to normalize it. Apartheid, ironically, is the plan of Israel's center slash, and then in parentheses, Zionist left. Center slash Zionist left. It is the liberal Israeli approach to, quote, peace, end quote. And I'm still here. I must treat my strained throat and voice to a delicious sugar-free drink. Liquid candy, as it were. And this is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Third scenario. One ethnocratic state. Hamas, right-wing Zionists, some anti-Zionist Israeli Jews, and perhaps a growing number of Palestinian intellectuals. He gives us an idea of the spectrum of persuasions that would be included. There is a remarkable mirror-like correspondence between Hamas and the right wing in Israel. The latter, you heard me right, folks, between Hamas, the governing body of the Gaza Strip, and the right wing regime in Israel. The latter, the right wing in Israel, ranging from the Likud through the religious settler movement, both contend that Palestine-Israel is one indivisible, it says here, country that, quote, belongs exclusively to Palestinians or Israelis, respectively, and for both, the claim to exclusivity rests primarily on religion, Palestine being the Islamic Waqf, W-A-Q-F, Waqf land, the land of Israel, or Eretz Israel, in Hebrew, given to the Jews by God. Although Zionism secularized that claim, its ethnocratic nationalism continued to assert an exclusive claim over the whole country. Both would allow the others to continue living in the country, but only as second-class citizens. Hamas would permit individual Jews to continue living in Palestine, but as Jews, not a national minority called Israelis. By the same token, right-wing Zionists would tolerate individual Arabs living in Israel, but also not as a national Palestinian minority. There are also voices among a number of prominent anti-Zionist Israeli Jews, Palestinian intellectuals, and academics sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, denying the very existence and legitimacy of Israel. Viewing Jewishness as merely a cultural or religious identity, but not a national one, or rather an invented and therefore fictional national one, as it were, they have gravitated to the position that Zionism was nothing but a form of settler colonialism and that, therefore, Israel, in quotes, and Israelis, in quotes, are nothing more than artificial and illegitimate colonial constructs. These ideas amongst the many voices expressing opinions about the basis of what's going on there. Continuing. Finally, warehousing, quote-unquote, a strategy of the Likud center-right Israeli governments is yet another variation on the theme of one ethnocratic state. A form of imprisonment, the term warehousing comes from the prison world. It is never declared as policy or even mentioned. Rather, it simply becomes, by default, the political reality. For Israel's past and present Likud center-right governments, even apartheid represents too much of a concession. After all, it requires the establishment of a Bantustan. Netanyahu and company say 15% is too much of, quote, our land to give to the Arabs. Why should they get anything? This is according to Prime Minister Netanyahu and his cohorts. In their view, the status quo is perfect. There is no political process. The Palestinians have been pacified to a significant extent by their own American-trained PA militias. That's Palestinian Authority militias. And Israel de facto rules the entire country. Besides mild criticism, the international community stands firmly behind Israel, or at least will never sanction it. Netanyahu and company believe they can get away with warehousing. So why compromise on any solution? After the 2013 election, his government declared its goal of, and I quote, 1 million Jews in Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria are words from the Bible and from ancient Jewish scripture, referring to what is more secularly and universally referred to as the West Bank. And Netanyahu and his cohorts declared its goal of establishing 1 million Jews in the West Bank. Despite a certain internal logic that might contain elements of truth, especially reference to Zionism's settler colonial behavior, and none of these options are inclusive, and none, in my view, in Dr. Halper's view, would win the support of progressives. Next scenario, one state, Palestinians on the left. And of course that refers to politically left-leaning Palestinians coming from them. One state, although the contours of a solution shifted over time, one element shared by both Palestinians and Israelis of the left remained the same for a long time. Whatever form peace eventually took, it would be inclusive. On one level, this is expressed most explicitly in two documents. The One State Declaration, issued in November on 29 November. I'm sorry. The One State Declaration, issued in London on 29 November 2007 by the One Democratic State Group, and a similar, if more detailed, declaration entitled One State in Palestine, which calls for a republic in historic Palestine, Both were authored primarily by Palestinian intellectuals with important input from a number of Israelis and others. The principles they suggest as the basis of a single state reflected... Again, the principles they suggest as the basis of a single state reflected, express the values, reflected the values and structures of liberal Western democracies. The London Declaration begins by affirming that, and I open the quote here, the historic land of Palestine belongs to all who live in it, and to those who were expelled or exiled from it since 1948, regardless of religion, ethnicity, national origin, or current citizenship status. And adds, again in quotes, any system of government must be founded on the principle of equality in civil, political, social, and cultural rights for all citizens. Both documents naturally include provisions of restorative justice, the right of return for Palestinian refugees, of course, and their inclusion in the building of the new state, together with, quote, redress for the devastating effects of decades of Zionist colonialization in the pre- and post-state period. What I generally refer to as reconciliation and or reconstruction. What these declarations omit, however, is any reference to national or collective rights. Since their Palestinian signers continue to invoke their national rights, it is not clear what status Israeli Jews will in fact enjoy in this conception of a democratic state. Even if Israeli Jews are allowed to stay in Palestine as individual Jewish citizens, would they ever agree to stop being Israelis? A lot rides on this question, even if it is left unstated. And I will return to the issues of inclusivity and equality. Next scenario. One binational state. Folks, this is a word, a phrase that has appeared in both this commentary and the previous one I read on this show, binational state. This scenario describes one binational state dominated by Israeli Jews with Palestinian autonomy. And this pretty much comes from the settler movement. Or some of the settlers, anyway. Committed to the idea of an indivisible land of Israel, the Yesha, which is to say, Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, Council of Settlements proposed in 2003 a binational state divided into 10 ethno-national cantons under a single federal government. But separation of Jews from Arabs and Jewish control of the entire country are also fundamental principles for the settlers. In their plan, then, only two of the cantons would be Palestinian, thus guaranteeing an overwhelming Jewish majority. Another version of federalism, advocated by Elazar and academics of the Israeli right, envision a country where the Palestinians remain but as Jordanian citizens. And thumbing through and identifying the range of possible solutions, the last one Dr. Halper offers is one democratic binational state as proposed by anti- or post-Zionist Israeli Jews. That is a very interesting term there, post-Zionist. Offered by anti-Zionist or post-Zionist Israeli Jews, critical Palestinian intellectuals, and a good number of Palestinians in Israel and in the diaspora. The diaspora? The word diaspora actually being a Greek word. The diaspora, as is generally recognized around the globe, refers to, chronologically, first to the dispersion and spread of Jewish refugees since the times of ancient Israel, well over 2,000 years ago, the diaspora used to mean almost exclusively the spread, the dispersion of Jews, not all of which, by the way, came from the ancient land, but the dispersion of Jews around the world. And more recently, diaspora has come to refer also to Palestinians, the Palestinian refugees, who have sort of also seen fit to emigrate far and wide around the globe. And diaspora has generally come to mean a dispersion of any one people's due to political, military, or other forces. Or nudges, as it were. Okay. One democratic binational state, anti- or post-Zionist Israeli Jews, critical Palestinian intellectuals, and a good number of Palestinians in Israel, in the Jewish state of Israel, and from the diaspora, the Palestinian diaspora. In Dr. Halper's view, the majority of anti- or post-Zionist Israeli Jews support a binational alternative over a unitary democracy. Although historically only the Marxist Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine supported such an outcome, a majority of Palestinians would probably accept it, or at least not oppose it, if only out of an acknowledgement of the political fact of Israel's existence. The vision of a democratic binational state is fairly straightforward. The two peoples share a common country. The hyphen in Palestine-Israel assumes prime importance. The challenge being to find a balance between collective rights of national self-determination and equal individual civil rights. No easy task, but as Marin Benvenisti and others have pointed out, a binational reality already exists and functions de facto, despite official Israeli efforts to contain and thwart it. Meron Benvenisti, by the way, I, as I recall the name, I believe he is a former mayor of Jerusalem, or that might have been another Benvenisti. Okay, now we move along to bridging a growing gap. Can a common vision be achieved? Actually, what we're going to do is I'm going to play some more Hungarian music here. That's some segue, isn't it, folks? Hungarian music on this Mideast Madness show. Okay. It is 4:29, 1629 hours, Pacific Daylight Time. We're not even halfway through this, so let's go, go, go. Moving along from the spectrum of possible solutions to a new heading now, bridging a growing gap. Can a common vision be achieved? So, where does this all leave us? Which alternative do we choose that is as just and achievable as possible? Any political struggle is characterized by a necessary give and take between ideology, analysis, and justice on the one hand, and political realities on the other. The absence of meaningful political movement on the Israeli-Palestinian issue over the last few years and the steady advancement of Israel's quote-unquote facts on the ground to a point where there is no more possibility of even a small Palestinian state has destroyed that give and take. And again, this is according to Dr. Jeff Halper, Ph.D. of ICAD, headquartered in Jerusalem, continuing with his commentary from last April 10th. The shift to the, quote, settler colonial, end quote, discourse by many of the most articulate Palestinian intellectuals and activists carries the risk of disconnecting political analysis from political reality in which two peoples inhabit the country, thus neutralizing his useful contribution to peacemaking. It's noncommittent. Boy, the way this person writes. Aha. There is a phone call on line one. Hi, this is Free Radio. Hi, who's there, please? Nobody. Thanks very much. Not so much as a howdy do. Another half minute wasted. And again, was it one of so many wrong numbers, or was it harassment by the bad guys? That's a minute wasted now. Where was I? Okay, trying to figure out the meat of the sentence here because it's written so poorly. Noncommittent. I don't know. In noncommitment, the withdrawal of Palestinian activists from working with even anti-Zionist Israeli activist under the rubric, quote, anti-normalization is similarly self-defeating. That is not to say that an argument could not be made that Zionism was indeed a settler colonial movement and therefore Israelis do not constitute a legitimate nationality. Collins, Pitterberg, Shafir, and Veracini make a strong case for that. These would all be names from Dr. Helper's by now quite obvious extensive resources on the subject. Make a strong case for that. But following the inner logic of that analysis, to the exclusion of political realities leads to political formulations that structurally prevent Israelis and Palestinians from arriving at a common framework of coexistence. Indeed, an equally strong case could be made that Zionism, for all its settler colonial crimes of displacement and replacement against the Palestinian people, was in fact a genuine national movement, at least in its initial impulse. Self-determination means just that. Self-determination. say what they want. Palestinian critics of Zionism are not those who decide whether Jews are a nation, a people, a culture, or just a religion, whether they have a genuine tie to the land of Israel, or whether they in fact possess the right of self-determination. This is so even if their identity and narrative are invented, quote-unquote, as are all national identities, including that of the Palestinians. Settler colonial is not the only possible framework for viewing the problem. One could make just as strong a case that we are witnessing a clash of legitimate national movements. Now, Dr. Helper has the following sentences in bold letters. Let's see why. Be that as it may, I will make an assumption here that no solution will win widespread acceptance unless it conforms to human rights and international law, unless it embodies substantive justice regarding all the parties involved, unless it is inclusive. No solution that entails the forced expulsion of an entire community or their exclusion from full participation in a future polity will or should be accepted. As Khaled Mashal has said, our concern is to liberate Palestine, not to create more refugees. I warned everyone in advance, this man, this Dr. Jeff Halper, has very extensive vocabulary, has written a lot of books, and has a lot on his head. So sometimes you really have to put on the old thinking cap and concentrate to stick with him until the end of his sentences. Okay, new paragraph here in the commentary. I am saying all this because the status of Israeli Jews in the Palestinian state envisioned by the authors of the London and One Democratic State declarations is left unclear. Indeed, the question is either ignored or fudged. True, the declarations speak of the, quote, creation of a non-sectarian or non-religious state that does not privilege the rights of one ethnic or religious group over another, end quote, affirming that, quote, any system of government must be founded on the principle of equality in civil, political, social, and cultural rights for all citizens, end quote. In this, they return to the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization's notion of a secular democratic state. But what of the collective national rights of both peoples? The answer is vague. Ethnic, religious, cultural, or national minorities, says the London Declaration, shall be protected by law but not assigned any specific rights, end quote. Where does that leave Palestinians and Israeli Jews, neither of whom can be described as, quote, national minorities? They're both being expected to renounce their national identities and rights of self-determination in order to become simply individual voters. I'm sorry, that's the question, followed by a question mark. Are they both being expected to renounce their national identities and rights of self-determination in order to become simply individual voters? And then in bold type again, Dr. Halper writes, one should distinguish between binational and secular democratic states, cautioned Edward Said, the great Palestinian-American intellectual and author. He said, these terms cannot be used interchangeably, end quote. And is this really the whole story? In an early discussion of the one-state solution, Nasir Arouri argued that, quote, a solution will require determined, systematic, and protracted struggle unifying Palestinians as a whole with Israeli Jews who wish to be neither masters of another people privileged in an apartheid system, nor colonial settlers denying the existence of the indigenous peoples and wishing for their disappearance, end quote. Pretty potent sentence. pretty potent quotation. Over the past 4 to 5 years, however, with the rise of, quote, Zionism as settler colonialism, the discourse of the Palestinian left has changed and become less transparent. In bold type, how does one reconcile the principle of a non-sectarian state that does not privilege the rights of one ethnic or religious group over another with this? Quote, there can be no inherent or acquired Jewish right to self-determination in Palestine that is equivalent, even morally symmetric, to the Palestinian right to self-determination, as this would blur the essential differences between the inalienable rights of the indigenous population and the acquired rights of the colonial settler population. End quotation. The latter position articulated by Omar Barghouti and quoted approvingly by Ali Abunima, both of whom were signatories to the London Declaration. Incidentally, Omar Barghouti is a major perpetrator of the BDS movement, or, to be somewhat less negative about it, proponents of the BDS movement, and Ali Abunima is editor-in-chief of the Electronic Intifada. Continuing with commentary. Such a view, shared though not usually articulated by clearly so many of the Palestinian left, begins to resemble the position of Hamas, or inversely the settlers, based though it is on anti-colonial indigenous rights rather than religion. It leaves unclear the civil status of Israelis/Jews in this one democratic but not binational state. At best, this would lead to an ethnocracy comparable to Israel today, with Israeli Jews possessing the unacceptable civil status suffered by Israeli Arabs today. Or it might take the form of Zimbabwe, where a European minority was allowed to stay but ended up with limited civil rights, or even an Algeria in North Africa, where the French settler colonialists were forced to leave immediately upon liberation. In short, crucial issues of collective rights in a single state have been left deliberately vague. The urgent task before us, I contend, is to reunite our analysis with the political and sociological realities on the ground, or risk rendering ourselves theoretically correct, but politically irrelevant. How can we take the disparate elements and principles contained in the various scenarios presented above, those we can consider accepting, of course, and begin formulating a common vision of a just and comprehensive peace? Permit me to offer a set of fundamental elements shared by progressives upon which, I would argue, any just and workable resolution of the conflict must be based. Following that, we can return to the various scenarios, combining the best elements they offer and fleshing them out until we begin to arrive at a program for which we can actively advocate among governments and the international public alike. All right. And here are Dr. Halper's essential elements of a just and sustainable Israeli-Palestinian peace. What then are those fundamental elements upon which a just peace must be based? Building on what has been suggested in past discussions and declarations, as well as upon my own analysis of what is just and achievable, I offer these 7 as a starting point. 1. A just peace and the process leading up to it must conform to human rights, international law, and the United Nations resolutions in respect to both the collective and individual rights of both peoples. The Oslo process failed primarily because it was based only on power relations. And if power alone determines the outcome, Israel wins, and the conflict, as we are witnessing today, becomes irresolvable. Inequality and oppression are inevitable when human rights and international law are brushed aside. Two, a just peace must accept the binational reality of Palestine-Israel and be inclusive of both peoples. National identities cannot be ignored or denied. A just peace must be inclusive. Two peoples reside in Palestine-Israel, and the collective as well as individual rights of both must be respected and protected. Since both peoples aspire to national self-determination, a right firmly embodied in international law, national expression must be provided for both Palestinians and Israelis. My mic is misbehaving here. Come on, you little sucker. Hi, folks. Pirate radio for you here. All right, where was I? Still on number two. The two peoples are not merely ethnic groups in a larger national society or simply a collection of individuals, but comprise national identities in themselves. The right to self-determination, to participation without discrimination in public affairs, to develop and advance one's community economically, socially, culturally, and politically has been authoritatively upheld by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, in its 2004 advisory opinion. Here's the quotation from that opinion. The court also notes that the principle of self-determination of peoples has been enshrined in the United Nations Charter and reaffirmed by the General Assembly in Resolution 2625 of XXV, cited above, pursuant to which, subquote, every state has the duty to refrain from any forcible action which deprives peoples referred to in that resolution of their right to self-determination, end subquote, end quote. Dr. Halper's point number three, a just peace must find a balance between collective rights or self-determination and individual rights or democracy. Point four, a just peace requires that the refugee issue be addressed directly. 80% of the Palestinians are refugees. 80%, that's four-fifths, my friends. Therefore, any sustainable peace is dependent upon the just resolution of this issue. A package of three elements is required. Israeli acceptance of the refugees' right of return. He puts in italics the word right of return, as set down in UN General Assembly Resolution 194, the aforementioned Resolution 194, rather than limited goodwill or humanitarian gestures. Israeli acknowledgement of its responsibility in creating the refugee issue, a symbolic act upon which closure and eventual reconciliation between the peoples depends. And only then technical solutions involving a mutually agreed upon combination of repatriation, resettlement elsewhere, and compensation. Point number five. A just peace must be economically viable. All the inhabitants of Palestine-Israel must have equal access to the country's basic resources and economic institutions. Here, post-apartheid South Africa presents a cautionary tale. How a unitary state was created that endowed all the country's citizens with equal political rights, but economically retained a structure that has rendered much of the black African population a permanent underclass. Once viable economic and political structures are in place, the Palestinian diaspora can be expected to invest in the country, supporting especially in the Palestinian sector, just as the Jewish diaspora has done. This constitutes a resource of major significance that is seldom taken into account in discussion of the Palestinians' future or their ability to achieve parity with Israeli Jews. Point number six, a just peace must address the security concerns of all in the region. He does not expound on that point. And finally, point number seven, a just peace must be regional in scope. Israel-Palestine is too small to address, is too small a unit to address all the issues at stake, be they refugees, water, security, economic development, environmental sustainability, or others that are by nature regional. Such a broadening of any peace process is necessary if Israel-Palestine is to have a suitable regional environment in which to integrate. The almost exclusive focus on Israel-Palestine has obfuscated another crucial dimension of the conflict, its regional context. And we are actually about two-thirds of the way through the text of the actual commentary. It's one of many regular commentaries on the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions website, which is directed by Dr. Jeff Halper. This is a really long one. It is a commentary, and I wanted to at least start it because he gets into so much detail about the problems as he observes them and interprets them that exist today, and a prognosis. I like to use the word prognosis for getting through those problems by coming to certain agreements and working together. I'll have to decide if I want to finish it or not. We're 4 minutes from the end of today's episode of Mideast Madness. By the way, this he follows the text of his commentary with many, many resources on ethnopolitics and the one-state solution. Not that I'll be reading them, but be assured that there are many, many, many footnotes that the good doctor provides to us for where he's coming from. Okay, it's 4:52 p.m. Stay tuned for daily headline show, Palestine Today, from the IMEMC. Because, as you've heard me say so often, or even if you haven't heard me say it, as I've said so often since this became the reality, Free Radio Santa Cruz is an internet-only radio service for the time being. If I'm going to pound on the desk here, I probably shouldn't do so to accentuate every word that I'm saying. So I did 3 pounds in succession. Temporarily, we are without traditional radio dial service. You cannot pick us up on your radio set unless it itself is tied into the net. Largely due to that, since so few people are currently listening to the show, and I'm just verifying that right now. Reload that. And, one more has been listening. I'm going to concentrate on producing these shows as though there is an audience out there, and then maybe I will fashion a way to play reruns of them post re-erection of our antenna. So when we're on the regular radio again, I can play them as reruns in my presence. In other words, I'll simply do a refeed of the show and break in where I feel it's necessary, and people will still call in if they wish. I can interrupt that stream and we can deal with the matters. Now, that will not happen until after our antenna is up, which will be soon, folks. I speak in all vagueness and crossing fingers on both hands. We'll be up again soon on the regular old-fashioned radio. Until then, I, of course, will be back next Monday at 3 p.m., as I'm here every Monday. Don't forget the weekend version or weekend edition, whatever you want to call it, of Mideast Madness, this very same show, every Saturday starting at 11 in the morning. Every Saturday. It's not a repeat of the Monday show, and this show is not a repeat of last Saturday. They are always scheduled to be live shows. Two versions. 3 hours and 55 minutes every week of Mideast Madness. Send your messages to MideastMadness at gmx.com. That's G as in generalization, X as in xenophobe, M as in manly.com. Ta-ta.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, August 5th, 2013. Israeli troops attack West Bank town and leave injured civilians while the government approves more homes in illegal settlements. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A number of Palestinian civilians were injured on Monday when Israeli troops invaded Al-Khadr town near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem.